Chapter 11. Checking into the Hanoi Hilton, then checking out, and the Panmunjom playtime. When the 2018 congressional elections concluded, another Trump-Kim summit looked depressingly inescapable. Trump's fascination with obtaining a deal with the North waxed and waned, but with over 6 months having passed since the Singapore summit and nothing much happening, waxing was becoming ascendant. Pompeo was to meet North Korea's Kim Jong-chol in New York on Thursday, November 8th, and Kim wanted another White House meeting that day or the next. Fortunately, I would be in Paris preparing for Trump's upcoming visit, so there would be no repeat of the spring 2018 scene. It still turned my stomach to imagine Kim Jong-chol back in the Oval. Then, mercifully, Kim Jong-un canceled the trip. Prospects for a Moon Kim summit were also going nowhere, at best being kicked into 2019. After New Year's, though, the pace increased. Not that it took much to fire up Trump. Kim Jong-un flew unexpectedly to Beijing on his birthday, January 8th, very likely to prepare for another Trump meeting. Sure enough, next up was a Kim Jong-chol visit to Washington on January 17th and 18th with a Trump meeting on Friday the 18th. I couldn't wait. I explained to Pompeo I had a minor surgery long scheduled for that day. He asked if I was sure I didn't need some help. Kim Jong-chol brought along another Kim Jong-un letter, and the Oval Office meeting lasted 90 minutes, obviously making surgery preferable. Charlie Kupperman, who had recently replaced Rick Ardell, attended the session, reporting that the discussion rambled, typically, and loose language was undoubtedly used. Nonetheless, he saw no real Trump commitments, and at the end, Trump said he couldn't lift sanctions until North Korea denuclearized, or he would look like a fool, which was true, and it was good Trump still remembered it. That may not normally be the basis for grand strategy, but it's what we had to work with. Staff-level negotiations were scheduled over the weekend in Sweden, and it was there I feared things would start slipping out of control. Indeed, according to press reports, that seemed ever more likely, especially since North Korea had finally named a counterpart to the State Department's special envoy, Steve Biegun, one Kim Hyok-chol, a veteran of the Bush 43-era six-party talks. This was not a good sign. With the summit venue and dates fixed for Hanoi on February 27th and 28th, I thought hard about how to prevent a debacle. Remarks by Biegun at Stanford strongly implying that the administration was prepared to follow the action-for-action formula demanded by North Korea only increased my concern, compounded by the State Department's reversion to type, uncooperative and uncommunicative on what they were telling the North Koreans. The State Department had done exactly the same thing to the NSC during the six-party talks. It was possible that Pompeo was not fully aware that Biegun's personal agenda to get a deal was so firm. But whether Pompeo ordered Biegun's enthusiasm, allowed it, or was ignorant of it was beside the point. The dangerous consequences were the same. Since states' negotiators seemed to be spinning out of control, overcome by zeal for the deal and intoxicated by the publicity, I considered what to do with Trump personally to prevent mistakes in Hanoi. I concluded that Trump's pre-Hanoi briefings needed to be significantly different from those before Singapore, which had had little impact. The first Hanoi prep session was on February 12th in the sit room, starting at 4:45 and lasting 45 minutes. We showed a film, opening with news clips of Carter, Clinton, Bush, and Obama all saying they had achieved great deals with North Korea, then turning to North Korea's actual conduct since Singapore and how they were still deceiving us. The film ended with clips of Reagan describing his 1986 Reykjavik summit with Gorbachev. Reagan's point was that when you held firm, you got better deals than when you gave in. There was a smooth flow of discussion. Trump asked good questions, and the session was remarkably focused. When we finished, Trump himself said the key points he carried away were, "I've got the leverage. I don't need to be rushed, and I could walk away. The briefing allowed Trump to conclude that Hanoi was not make or break. If no real progress emerged, he could simply proceed as before. I couldn't have scripted it better. Our economic pressure on North Korea was greater than before, but it was a matter of degree. The sanctions nonetheless gave us a near-term advantage. Kim Jong-un was the one more desperate for the deal because the squeeze, while far from perfect, continued to frustrate his efforts to deliver economic improvement inside his country. Over the long term, time always benefited the proliferator, but my definition of long term was now 2 weeks. Getting past the Hanoi summit without making catastrophic concessions and compromises. If we stalled any rush to make a deal just to say we had, which was the State Department's every inclination, I would be satisfied. I foresaw the pressure on us to deal declining once we were past the second Trump-Kim summit. We could instead refocus on the very grave threat the North still represented, whether or not they were actively testing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. I felt enormously relieved the briefing hadn't been a disaster, and that we might even have made progress with Trump. The second briefing on February 15th, just after 2 o'clock, again lasted about 45 minutes. We ran an excerpt from a North Korean propaganda film showing them still engaged in robust war games, even if we weren't, pursuant to Trump's orders. He was very interested in the video and asked to have a copy. We focused on the most important point, the meaning of complete denuclearization. Trump asked for the conclusions on a single sheet of paper which we had already prepared. After a good discussion, Trump said, "Clean this up and get it back to me," which suggested he might hand it to Kim Jong-un at some point. I stressed the importance of getting a full baseline declaration, not the piecemeal approach that the State Department would accept. I thought this second briefing also went extremely well, accomplishing all we could expect to get Trump into the right frame of mind so as not to give away the store in Hanoi. Even another phone call with South Korea's Moon Jae-in, persistently pushing South Korea's agenda on February 19th, didn't cause major damage. Trump proclaimed that he was the only person who could make a nuclear deal with Kim Jong-un. He pressed Moon to let the media know that progress was being made, since they typically tried to put a negative spin on whatever he did. He promised to keep South Korea's interests in mind, but stressed that Kim wanted a deal. They all wanted deals. Later that morning, Pompeo, Biegun, the NSC's Allison Hooker, and I yet again had a meeting with Trump, during which he said, "If we walk away, it's okay." The main point made in the briefings. To Biegun, Trump said, "Tell them, the North Koreans, how much I love Chairman Kim, but also tell them what I want." After further discussions, Pompeo and I went back to my office to talk about Hanoi. I stressed again why a baseline declaration by North Korea was the starting point for any intelligible negotiation. I also underlined why we couldn't give up economic sanctions and why we needed more pressure. Pompeo bristled at my interference with his turf, but he didn't disagree on the substance, which he rarely did when we talked alone. At a principals committee later that day on North Korea, the clear weakness Biegun displayed disturbed many of those present, especially Shanahan and Dunford, even Pompeo. Was he managing Biegun or wasn't he? Dunford wanted to be sure that any end-of-war declaration would not have binding legal effect, which of course raised the question of why we were considering it at all. The North had told us they didn't care about it, seeing it as something Moon wanted. So why were we pursuing it? The third and final North Korea briefing on February 21st followed a call with Abe the day before that couldn't have teed it up better. We had prepared a set of wild cards that Kim Jong-un might bring to Hanoi to surprise Trump and get him to make unnecessary concessions. Once again, lasting about 45 minutes, the session was a successful conclusion to our briefing efforts. Whether they would suffice to prevent catastrophic concessions to Kim remained to be seen. I left for Hanoi early on February 24th. Flying toward our refueling stop in Anchorage, we received a draft U.S.-North Korea statement. The NSC's Allison Hooker said Biegun had table-dropped it at a meeting with the North without previously clearing it. It read as if drafted by North Korea, enumerating all Trump's prior concessions to Kim Jong-chol in the Oval Office without seeking anything in return beyond another vague statement that North Korea would agree to define denuclearization. It was a complete mystery to me why Pompeo would allow such a text. What if the North Koreans simply accepted it word for word? This was another massive process foul and a political time bomb. I had Kupperman show the draft to Mulvaney and Stephen Miller in Washington, and Mulvaney agreed it was both a first-magnitude political mistake and a deliberate violation of the established interagency process. They were flying with Trump to Hanoi on Air Force One and explained the problems to him en route. Trump was completely unaware of the draft, so Biegun had no authority from on high. I also called Pence on Air Force Two as he flew back to Washington from the Lima Group meeting in Bogota, and he had the same reaction to the Biegun draft that I did. Having been overwhelmed by Venezuela before leaving for Hanoi, once there and ensconced in the U.S. delegation's hotel, the JW Marriott, I tried to learn what was going on. The record was very confused, but the State Department was working overtime to lock down everything they could on Biegun's draft, excluding NSC and Defense Department representatives, before Trump arrived late that evening. It was all bad news. The next morning, Wednesday, February 27th, Mulvaney told Pompeo and me that Trump was very unhappy about a Time magazine story on his intelligence briefings and how little he paid attention or understood them. I hadn't heard of the story, although Pompeo had, saying Time was doing a profile of him, which was perhaps where it had come up. He was willing to issue a statement similar to one he had made months before that Trump was deeply involved in the briefings. I had not made such a statement before and was looking for exits from the hotel room so I wouldn't have to now. The Time article nearly severed an already tense relationship with the intelligence community. Trump called Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats an idiot and asked Pompeo and me in the elevator later, "Did we make a mistake with CIA Director Gina Haspel?" We then trooped to another room set up to brief Trump for the day's events. Trump was still on fire because of the Time article, but started by telling Pompeo he didn't like Biegun's comments, which were too much, referring to the draft statement Kupperman and Mulvaney had shown him on Air Force One. The import was clear to everyone in the room. After a detour on the Time article, Trump again criticized Biegun, repeating what he had said just minutes before. For the record, when he saw Biegun the next morning, he didn't recognize him. Trump said he saw three possible outcomes: a big deal, a small deal, or I walk. He immediately rejected the small deal because it would mean weakening the sanctions. The big deal wasn't going to happen because Kim Jong-un remained unwilling to make a strategic decision to renounce nuclear weapons. The idea of I walk came up repeatedly, which meant Trump was at least prepared for it and might even prefer it. Ditch the girl before she ditches you. There would be criticism no matter what he did, Trump said with a shrug, so I mentioned Reagan's walking away at Reykjavik and the important boost that gave to later negotiations, ironically, on the INF treaty, which we were leaving. Trump mused about what he would say at the concluding press conference. "We still like each other. We'll keep talking." And looking at me, said, "You should go out and defend it." Trump seemed consumed by the coming testimony in Washington of Michael Cohen, one of his former lawyers, a rare occasion when I saw his personal problems bleed into national security. I was relieved the earlier briefings were still top of mind and that the option of walking away was live. We spent the rest of the day in meetings with Vietnam's top leadership up until Trump's dinner with Kim Jong-un. By that time, morning in Washington, The news coverage was all Michael Cohen. The North Koreans excluded me from the dinner, with only Pompeo and Mulvaney attending with Trump, following a one-on-one with the two leaders. I didn't like it, but figured it was a cost of doing business. Mulvaney called me to his room after the dinner ended at 9 p.m. to debrief with Pompeo and others. Trump had wanted to avoid substance until the next morning, but as the dinner was ending, Pompeo said Kim had proposed that the North give up its Yongbyon nuclear facilities in exchange for the lifting of all post-2016 UN Security Council sanctions. This was a typical action-for-action ploy, giving them economic relief they desperately needed, but giving us very little, since even without Yongbyon, it was publicly well known that North Korea had many other facilities with which to continue its nuclear program. I asked if Kim Jong-un had something else up his sleeve, but Pompeo didn't think so. I also asked if Trump had raised the Japanese abductee issue, which he had, meaning he had fulfilled his commitment to Japan. I thought that was it for the evening, but word soon came that Shanahan and Dunford wanted to talk to Pompeo and me about a ballooning crisis between India and Pakistan. After hours of phone calls, the crisis passed, perhaps because, in substance, there never really had been one. But when two nuclear powers spin up their military capabilities, it is best not to ignore it. No one else cared at the time, but the point was clear to me. This was what happened when people didn't take nuclear proliferation from the likes of Iran and North Korea seriously. The next morning, February 28th, was the big day. Having stayed up well into the night watching Cohen testify, Trump canceled the preparatory briefings. I worried that his every instinct would be to do something to drown out Cohen's hearings in the media, which he could only do with something dramatic and unexpected. Walking out would certainly achieve that objective. So too, however, would making a deal he could characterize as a huge success, even if it was badly flawed. The flaws wouldn't catch up until later. Trump had Mulvaney, Pompeo, and me ride with him to the Metropole Hotel in The Beast. He had heard from someone that we should ask the North Koreans to give up their ICBMs, which I thought secondary to dismantling the nuclear warheads. Eliminating just the ICBMs would not reduce the dangers to South Korea, Japan, and our deployed forces, nor protect against shorter-range submarine-launched missiles fired just off our coasts, which the North was pursuing. Trump was irritable and frustrated, asking whether it was a bigger story if we got a small deal or if we walked away. I thought walking away was a far bigger story if that was what he was looking for. Trump wondered how to explain taking a walk, and Pompeo offered a line. The teams had met, we had made progress, there was still no testing, and we would meet again notwithstanding the failure of this summit, which Trump liked. It made me gag, but as long as Trump was comfortable with the explanation and walked away, I was not going to complain. He was moving in the right direction, but a fluttering leaf could have turned him 180 degrees. As we arrived at the Metropole, I had no sense of how the rest of the day would play out. Trump and Kim had a one-on-one at 9 a.m., which broke after about 40 minutes. They went to an inner courtyard where they were joined by Pompeo and Kim Jong-chol for what was intended to be a short, perhaps 10-minute break. Kim Jong-un did not like the heat and humidity, so they went inside a greenhouse-type structure in the inner courtyard used as a cafe, undoubtedly air-conditioned. The discussion continued as we watched it through the greenhouse windows. My take was that Kim did not look particularly happy. His sister stood stoically outside in the heat and humidity, while the Americans, needless to say, went inside nearby where it was air-conditioned. After about an hour, this meeting broke, and Trump came into the main structure of the hotel for what was described as a 30-minute break. In the holding rooms allocated to us, Trump immediately switched on Fox News to see how the late-night shows were covering Cohen's testimony, as well as events in Hanoi. Pompeo said the discussion that had just concluded, like the one at dinner, had been all about North Korea's closing down Yongbyon in exchange for sanctions relief, which wasn't going anywhere. Kim Jong-un, he said, was very frustrated and was getting angry that Trump wasn't giving him what he wanted. There had been no talk of ballistic missiles. The rest of the North's nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons programs, or anything other than Yongbyon. Trump was visibly tired and irritated. It was clear he too was frustrated no satisfactory deal was at hand. That told me we were still in perilous territory. It was never over with Trump until he announced it at a press conference, and sometimes not even then. He still seemed comfortable walking away. There was no big deal in sight, and he could not sustain a small deal politically. I believed Trump's head-for-the-barn instincts were kicking in. He wanted to get it over with and return home, after, of course, the big press conference. The larger meeting, Trump, Pompeo, Mulvaney, and I on our side of the table, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-chol, and Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho on their side, plus interpreters, was scheduled for 11 a.m. We arrived first, then the North Koreans, and we all shook hands. I said to Kim Jong-un, "Mr. Chairman, it's very nice to see you again," which I hoped would be true. The press mob came in and out, and Trump asked Kim, "Does the press give you a hard time?" Somewhat stunned, Kim said, "That's an obvious question. I don't have that burden," and laughed. On human rights, Trump said happily we could say we talked about human rights because the press asked Kim a question. Another laugh fest. Turning serious, Trump asked what Kim had come up with during the break. Kim was unhappy that he had traveled all the way to Hanoi with a proposal he claimed was incomparable to all those put on the table by all of their predecessors, and even so, Trump was not satisfied. This went on for some time. While Kim was talking, Trump asked me for the definition of denuclearization we had discussed in the Washington briefings, and also for what we called the Bright Future page, which I gave him. He handed both pages to Kim and offered to fly him back to North Korea, canceling his evening in Hanoi. Kim laughed and said he couldn't do that, but Trump observed happily that that would be quite a picture. He asked what North Korea could add to its offer. He knew Kim didn't want him to look bad because he was the only one on Kim's side. Kim readily returned the compliment since he was the only one on Trump's side. Doubtless, without intending the pun, Trump observed that Kim called the shots in North Korea. Kim seemed surprised that Trump saw things that way, but said that even a leader who controlled everything still could not move without providing some justification. Trump said he understood Kim wanted to achieve consensus. Kim stressed again how significant the Yongbyon concession was for North Korea and how much coverage the idea was getting in the U.S. media. Trump asked again if Kim could add something to his offer, such as asking only for a percentage reduction in the sanctions rather than completely removing them. This was beyond doubt the worst moment of the meeting. If Kim Jong-un had said yes there, they might have had a deal, disastrously for America. Fortunately, he wasn't biting, saying he was getting nothing, omitting any mention of the sanctions being lifted. Trump tried changing the subject, asking about prospects for reunifying North and South Korea and what China thought. Kim, growing tired of diversions, asked to get back to the agenda. Still trying to improve Kim's package, Trump suggested he offer to eliminate his long-range missiles, the ones that could hit the United States. I saw this as an obvious dismissal of what I said earlier about the concerns of Japan and South Korea for the short- and medium-range missiles that could hit them. Then came the unexpected from Trump. "John, what do you think?" I wasn't going to miss the chance. We needed a full baseline declaration of North Korea's nuclear, chemical, biological, and ballistic missile programs, echoing the paper Trump had given Kim Jong-un, I said. This was a traditional step in arms control negotiations, and prior negotiations had failed without one. Trump responded that what I had just said was a little complicated, but looked to Kim for his reaction. Kim wasn't buying, urging that if we went step by step, that would ultimately bring us a comprehensive picture. He complained, as he had in Singapore, that North Korea had no legal guarantees to safeguard its security, and Trump asked what kind of guarantees the North wanted. There were no diplomatic relations, 70 years of hostility, and 8 months of personal relations, Kim answered, obviously unwilling to respond with specifics. What would happen if a U.S. warship entered North Korea's territorial waters, he asked, and Trump suggested Kim call him. After more back and forth, Trump acknowledged that they had reached an impasse that it was politically impossible for him to resolve in the current meeting. Kim now looked visibly frustrated, but I was worried. After sustained efforts to explain to Trump how dangerous North Korea's nuclear threat was, we were reduced to hoping that the politics of avoiding a mass Republican Party revolt was enough to stop a bad deal. Trump turned to Pompeo, asking him to repeat what he had said in The Beast on the way to the Metropole, which Pompeo rendered as, "The takeaway is the progress we have made. We understand each other better. We trust each other more. There was real progress made here. We can hold our heads high." I was glad I didn't have to say it. We turned to closing statements, which Kim wanted to be one joint document. Trump initially preferred separate statements, then decided he didn't. This went back and forth until Trump said again that he wanted to do a complete deal. Kim said flatly that the most he could do was what he had already proposed, which obviously wasn't going to happen. He asked instead for a Hanoi statement to show that progress was made, perhaps mentioning that we were thinking about Yongbyon. This was now going in the wrong direction again, but I had been shot down earlier by Trump for saying that a joint statement risked showing we hadn't achieved anything. "I don't need risks. I need positives," Trump responded. Pompeo wanted to talk about progress. "We have made progress in the last 8 months, and we will build on that." Even Kim wouldn't accept that, saying that we had obviously not reached a good point. Trump interjected emphatically that if we accepted Kim's proposal, the political impact in the United States would be huge and he could lose the election. Kim reacted quickly, saying he didn't want Trump to do anything that would harm him politically. Oh, great. Kim kept pushing for a joint statement, but lamented that he felt a barrier between the two leaders and felt a sense of despair. Kim was smartly playing on Trump's emotions, and I worried it might work. Trump said Kim shouldn't feel that way, and then, fortunately, we all laughed. Kim again stressed how important the Yongbyon package was. I said North Korea had already repeatedly promised to denuclearize, starting with the 1992 Joint North-South Declaration, so they already knew to a great extent what was required of them. Trump asked what had happened to the joint declaration, and I explained that Clinton had shortly thereafter negotiated the 1994 agreed framework. Trump lamented that it was Kim's proposal to lift the sanctions that was the deal breaker. Kim agreed that it was a shame, because he had thought the deal would receive a lot of applause. Instead, inside the room, there was total silence for several seconds, as we all thought the meeting had come to its end. But it hadn't ended, as Kim kept pushing for some reference to Yongbyon that showed he and Trump had made progress beyond what their predecessors had achieved. I jumped in again and pitched hard for two separate statements. I said if they were looking for a positive ending, we could each be positive in our own way. Kim said he didn't want his own statement, which brought several more seconds of silence. Trump said he wanted Kim to be happy. No words for that. Trump made it clear he wanted a joint statement, assigning it to Kim Yong-chol and Pompeo to draft. With that, the North Koreans trundled out, leaving the U.S. delegation alone in the room. While we were milling around, Trump asked me how we could be sanctioning the economy of a country that's 7,000 miles away. I answered, because they are building nuclear weapons and missiles that can kill Americans. That's a good point, he agreed. We walked over to where Pompeo was standing, and Trump said, I just asked John why we were sanctioning 7,000 miles away, and he had a very good answer, because they could blow up the world. Yes, sir, said Pompeo. Another day at the office. Trump went back to his holding room, and Pompeo told me that this larger meeting had been essentially a replay of the earlier smaller meeting, with Kim's relentlessly pushing the Yongbyon deal, hoping Trump would fold. In the holding room, we found Trump tired, but he expressed the correct insight that walking away in Hanoi made clear to the world he could do it elsewhere, such as in the China trade negotiations. Beyond that, however, he had no appetite for anything else, even lunch, which was canceled, along with the joint signing ceremony, tentatively on the calendar. Trump said he wanted both Pompeo and me on the stage with him at the press conference, but I explained I had to get to the airport to meet my takeoff slot to avoid a lengthy crew rest stop in Alaska, which he didn't seem entirely enthusiastic about. Pompeo said to me a few minutes later, "Lucky you." I left the Metropole for the airport at about 1 p.m., learning after takeoff that negotiations with the North on a joint statement had broken down. No surprise. Trump told Sanders just to put out a White House statement. Pompeo and Biegun did their own briefing, trying to make the summit sound like a success so Biegun's negotiations could continue. In fact, he was following the same failed approach of the three prior administrations, doomed to produce the same failed outcome. Flying to Washington, I concluded that Hanoi showed the U.S. still didn't know how to deal with North Korea and its ilk. We spent endless hours negotiating with ourselves, whittling away at our own position before our adversaries even got to it, a fine art the State Department had perfected. The North Koreans and others were expert at taking full advantage of those who wanted a deal, any deal, as a sign of success. We were a perfect mark. The real irony here was how similar Trump was to the Foreign Service. Another key mistake was constantly briefing the press on how successful the working-level negotiations were, raising media expectations of agreement and exaggerating the effects of getting no deal. Perhaps most important, through the pre-Hanoi briefing process, we had helped Trump conclude that walking away was no failure, thereby derailing the unhealthy negotiation path Biegun was on. But as with every success in government, this was a momentary triumph, and one I knew would not last long. The bureaucracy's inexorable drive to keep the process going would inevitably ignite again, as would Trump's deathless belief that everyone wanted to talk to him, that everyone was dying for a deal. After Hanoi, we learned from press sources such as South Korea's Chosun Ilbo that Kim Yong-chol had endured forced labor, although he was later rehabilitated, that Kim Yok-chol, Biegun's counterpart, had been executed, along with several others, that in penance, Kim Jong-un's sister had receded from public view for a time, and that Shin Hae-young, Kim's interpreter, was in a political prison camp for making an interpretation mistake. That, at least, was better than the previous report that she had been executed for failing to stop Trump from interrupting her translation of Kim Jong-un's glowing words. It was hard to verify any of this, but everyone knew the North Korean leader was fully capable of ordering such punishments. A Washington Post reporter, in yet another exercise of its responsible journalism, tweeted, "Looks like Trump's erratic diplomacy, including adopting maximalist Bolton positions in Hanoi, got some people killed." Reactions to the Hanoi summit almost uniformly reflected surprise, if not stunned disbelief. Condi Rice and Steve Hadley both called and expressed support for Trump's walkout, and Rice told me she had recounted to Pence one of my favorite Bush 43 anecdotes. Bush had likened Kim Jong-il to a child in a high chair, constantly pushing his food onto the floor, with the U.S. and others always picking it up and placing it back on the tray. Things hadn't changed much. The communists wouldn't learn until the food just stayed on the floor, if then. I spoke a few days later with South Korea's Chung Yi-young, who had an interesting take. He said they were surprised Kim Jong-un had come to Hanoi with only one strategy and no plan B. Chung also reflected Moon Jae-in's schizophrenic idea that while we were right to reject North Korea's action-for-action formula, Kim's willingness to dismantle Yongbyon, never defined clearly, was a very meaningful first step, showing that the North had entered an irreversible stage of denuclearization. This last contention was nonsense, as was Moon's endorsement of China's parallel and simultaneous approach, which sounded a lot like action for action to me. Chung was the first to predict, based on coverage of the summit in the North's Rodong Sinmun, available to ordinary people, as Chung described it, that some officials would be replaced, which turned out to be an understatement. Making a mistake in North Korean foreign policy could be fatal not only to your career, but to yourself. The surprise many people felt, especially U.S. commentators, stemmed from the State Department's relentless pre-Hanoi efforts to foreshadow that we would indeed accept some version of action for action. Speeches, quiet interviews with reporters and pundits, and seminars at think tanks all heralded we were about to reach those broad, sunlit uplands where one concession after another would flow from Washington. This was what State Department negotiators for years had understood to be the art of the deal. The people who really had no plan B after Hanoi were America's high-minded, who wanted nothing more than to return to the Clinton administration's agreed framework, or the Bush administration's six-party talks, or the Obama administration's strategic patience strategy. It turned out, on the road to Panmunjom, they were more patient than I gave them credit for. As time passed, however, the North was moving from being surprised to being outraged. On March 15th, our favorite North Korean Vice Foreign Minister Choe Son-hee blasted Pompeo and me for creating an atmosphere of hostility and mistrust in Hanoi through our uncompromising demands. I should have issued a statement thanking her. By contrast, she said the Trump-Kim relationship is still good and the chemistry mysteriously wonderful. Indeed. Then came the threat. Choe said Kim Jong-un would decide shortly whether to resume nuclear and ballistic missile testing, which induced enormous concern in South Korea's government. I spoke to Chung the same day, and he said Choe's statement had taken them by surprise. Nonetheless, they hoped her remarks were just reiterating what she had said in Hanoi in a late-night press conference after Trump had walked away. We watched Moon continue to press harder for another Moon-Kim summit, focused only on nuclear issues, perhaps because he saw his own inter-Korean policy being impacted. I sensed Trump beginning to worry he had been too tough in Hanoi, which manifested itself in several ways. He began saying again, "We shouldn't spend 10 cents on war games," referring to our exercises with South Korea. On the other hand, he never relented in supporting the economic maximum pressure campaign against North Korea. I held a principals committee on March 21st to assess whether the campaign was as maximum as it could be and to consider how to stiffen it up. The major issue for discussion was whether the United States should do more to inhibit ship-to-ship transfers at sea, coal being exported from North Korea and oil being imported. Through the ship-to-ship transfers, the North obviously hoped to escape surveillance, and I wanted to see if there were steps short of using force that would make it harder for these exchanges to take place. There was no discussion of additional sanctions against North Korea, only how to better enforce those already in place. The next day, a Friday, we were in Mar-a-Lago for Trump's meeting with the leaders of five Caribbean island states, the Bahamas, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, and St. Lucia. another encounter I several times urged him to do despite his objections, but which he later touted as his own idea. Trump pulled me and a few others into the library, really a bar off the lobby lounge, and said he wanted recent Treasury enforcement actions against two Chinese companies for violating North Korea sanctions rolled back. We had approved these decisions, all of which had been signed off on personally by Pompeo, Mnuchin, and me, which were enforcement measures under existing sanctions, not new sanctions broadening or enlarging what was already there. After Singapore, we had expressly reviewed this distinction with Trump. He agreed strict enforcement of existing sanctions would continue, and pursuant to that understanding, we had, in over 9 months since Singapore, penalized a significant number of companies and individuals for violations. Why Trump wanted to roll back these latest enforcement actions was anybody's guess, other than that he was feeling Kim Jong-un's pain. Trump dictated a tweet that could only be read as reversing the Treasury Department's recent announcement. I argued as strenuously as I could not to do so, with which Mulvaney fully agreed. We had no effect. The whole point, said Trump, was that the tweet was for an audience of one with whom he was trying to make a deal. It won't affect anything else, he said, ignoring my obviously futile efforts to explain that lots of other people would also see this tweet and would inevitably interpret it as weakening the sanctions and a public repudiation of his own advisors, especially Mnuchin. Trump simply didn't care. He wanted to send a message to Kim Jong-un, just as he had wanted to send a message to Xi Jinping when he rolled back Ross's ZTE sanctions after they had been publicly announced. Sanders asked what to say about why Trump had tweeted, and he replied, "I like Kim Jong-un, and these sanctions were unnecessary." The tweet went out. After we concluded with the Caribbean leaders discussing common regional challenges and headed for the airport, we saw media reports that Trump's North Korea tweet did not refer to what Treasury had announced on Thursday, but to other unspecified future sanctions that weren't yet public. Pompeo called me from the Middle East a little after 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and I tried to explain what was happening, but it was still confusing. We were, however, both thoroughly disheartened by what Trump's tweet had done. And this day, March 22nd, marked the first anniversary of Trump's offering me the NSC position. It only seemed like 10 years ago. On Saturday morning at about 7:30, I called Mulvaney, who had stayed at Mar-a-Lago. Mnuchin had called him Friday afternoon to speak with Trump, to urge that pulling down the new Treasury sanctions would be embarrassing to him. Mulvaney put the call through, and Mnuchin gave Trump the same analysis I had. Trump agreed, hours after disagreeing with precisely the same points, to keep the decisions in place. Hearing this, I asked Mulvaney if I had not been clear about this the day before. "You were very clear about it," said Mulvaney, "but sometimes it takes two or three tries to get it through." As for the future sanctions, Mulvaney said this was merely Treasury's ham-fisted way of explaining things. He and I decided to conference Mnuchin in. Mnuchin said he was trying to protect Trump from embarrassment by saying we wouldn't do additional sanctions, although he agreed that the rest of the world would conclude we were receding from maximum pressure. We all agreed, however, that correcting the correction, our new synonym for reversing, would only make things worse. Although I didn't initially like Mnuchin's cover story, as the day wore on, I couldn't think of anything better. We, or more accurately, Trump, might have appeared confused, but at least we didn't look too weak. I spoke later to Pompeo, and he also agreed we should just let matters lie. In any other administration, this affair would have been a major story, but for us, it passed almost unnoticed. The release of the Mueller report, which ended the Russia collusion issue, dominated news coverage. On Monday, with Pompeo and me in the Oval with Trump and Mnuchin on the phone, we reaffirmed what we had decided after Singapore, namely that enforcement actions would continue, but that we would not impose additional prohibitions on North Korea without Trump's approval. If Trump had simply listened on Friday, all this drama could have been avoided. One issue that bedeviled relations with South Korea and Japan, and to a lesser extent the European allies, was the question of what share of the costs of U.S. military bases the host country should pay. Virtually everywhere we had bases, the host country paid some costs, but the amounts and formulas varied, and there was no real agreement on what the actual costs were. Under the Defense Department's creative accounting techniques, almost any cost figure could be justified, high or low. As with other military funding issues, Trump thought our allies weren't paying enough. This fit with his notion, unshakable after countless discussions, that we were in, say, South Korea, to defend them. We were not there for collective defense or mutual security or any of that complex international stuff. We were defending Germany, or defending Japan, or defending Estonia, whatever, and they should pay for it. Moreover, as any good business person would tell you, we should make a profit from defending all these countries in which the U.S. had no particular interest. Why are we in all these countries? Trump would ask. Or, at least we should get a better bargaining strategy, starting at the outset of negotiations each time the host country's support agreements came up for renewal. Trump had long had the idea that host countries should pay cost plus X percent of U.S. costs, as he said back in April 2018, pressing for Arab forces to replace us in Syria, see Chapter 2. In time, he was persuaded that cost plus 50% sounded too raw, so he called what he was asking for by various other names, such as fair share or full and fair reimbursement of our costs. Make no mistake, however, the actual dollar amount he wanted, or at least wanted to start negotiations with, remained cost plus 50%. In South Korea's case, under our special measures agreement, that amount was $5 billion annually, an enormous increase over the less than $1 billion per year Seoul was paying. The current agreement was nearing expiration on December 31, 2018, causing enormous concern at both the State Department and the Pentagon. They didn't want to charge host countries as if we were mercenaries, and also because they knew it would be hard to obtain such major increases. South Korea happened to be first because of the agreement's expiration date, and Japan was next, but all were ultimately in line to face the question. Because I feared Trump's ultimate threat, withdrawing our troops from any country not paying what he deemed to be an adequate amount, was real in South Korea's case, I tried to develop a strategy other than just refusing to do what Trump wanted. The latter was Mattis's approach, which had worked right up until Trump exploded and did what he wanted to do anyway. To state and defense, withdrawing U.S. forces from South Korea was inconceivable, so their sustained opposition to significantly raising host country payments just increased the risk. Unfortunately, I knew where the edge of the cliff was. In 2018, after inconclusive negotiations at the end of the calendar year, with December 31st bearing down on us, South Korea agreed to an increase in its costs well above current levels, but still less than $1 billion per year. That meant we now had another year to get a resolution both Trump and the South Koreans would accept, hopefully avoiding withdrawing U.S. forces. That's how things stood for several months into 2019. Obviously still concerned about the collapse at Hanoi, Moon Jae-in came to Washington on April 11th. Pompeo and I met first with Moon at Blair House at 9 a.m., along with Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa and Chung Yi-young. After the usual pleasantries, we learned the South had had no substantive contacts since the Hanoi summit with North Korea. The North needed more time to get over Hanoi. Moon was very worried that Pyongyang's cold shoulder on both the nuclear and inter-Korean issues was bad news for him politically, since his pitch was that sunshine would produce tangible results from the North, which it clearly was not doing. I tried to say as little as possible in this meeting and in the Moon-Trump meeting precisely because I knew Moon's government was looking for others to scapegoat, and within the U.S. team, I was the logical person to target as an obstructionist. And why not? Watching the success of Kim Jong-un's analogous strategy on Trump, it obviously worked. Moon arrived at the White House at noon, and after the usual press scrum in the Oval, Pompeo and I stayed with Trump to meet in a smaller setting with Moon, Kong, and Chung. Trump said he was getting a lot of credit for the way Hanoi had turned out, since it was better to walk away than to sign a bad deal. Moon thought that was fine, but he wanted something dramatic to generate momentum for what he thought could be the summit of the century. He urged a dramatic approach on timing, venue, and form, which could in turn lead to dramatic results, suggesting meeting either at Panmunjom or on a U.S. naval vessel. Trump cut through the monologue, which was fortunate because he had seemed to be falling asleep, stressing that he appreciated Moon's ideas, but underlining that his desire was for the next summit to produce an actual agreement. Meeting once without a deal was not a problem, but no one wanted to walk away twice. Moon, however, was still worried about form rather than substance, but what was really uppermost for him was stressing he was available to join Kim and Trump. Trump was not biting, insisting that there had to be a deal to eliminate North Korea's nuclear weapons before there was another summit. We adjourned to the cabinet room for a working lunch, and after reviewing North Korea developments and a little ramble through bilateral trade issues, Trump raised our base costs in South Korea. Trump explained that the bases cost us $5 billion annually, saying the U.S. lost $4 billion a year for the privilege of South Korea selling us televisions. Other countries had offered to pay significantly more, and in the next phase of the negotiations, South Korea should be more forthcoming. Trump conveyed that he felt he was very protective of Moon and had great respect for him. Moon tried to reply that many South Korean companies invested in the U.S. and pleaded that, regarding base costs, Trump's expectations were too high. Trump asked if the U.S. leased the land for its bases or whether it was free, which Moon didn't answer. Instead, he parried by saying South Korea spent 2.4% of its GDP on defense, which led Trump to criticize Germany for its inadequate defense expenditures. Then he was back to South Korea, which was freed from having to defend itself and therefore free to build. By contrast, the U.S. had spent $5 trillion for the privilege of defending the South, because they were the toughest negotiators of all. Trump wanted a formula fair to the U.S. After more North Korea discussions, Trump asked how relations were with Japan. We all saw the increasing difficulties between Tokyo and Seoul, which would worsen rapidly in the next few months. Moon was trying to upend a 1965 treaty between the two countries. That treaty aimed, certainly in Japan's view, to put an end to the animosities created by Japan's colonial rule over Korea from 1905 to 1945, especially World War II's hardships and the well-known comfort women issue. Moon said that history should not interfere with the future of relationships, but from time to time, Japan made it an issue. Of course, it wasn't Japan that was raising the history, but Moon, for his own purposes. My view was that, like other South Korean political leaders, Moon tried to make Japan an issue when times at home were difficult. Trump asked if South Korea could fight together with Japan as allies, despite not wanting to conduct exercises with Japan. Moon answered frankly that Tokyo and Seoul could conduct joint military exercises, but that having Japanese forces in Korea would remind people of history. Trump pressed again, wondering what would happen if we had to fight North Korea and whether South Korea would accept Japanese participation. Moon clearly didn't want to answer, saying we shouldn't worry about the issue and that South Korea and Japan would fight as one so long as there was no Japanese self-defense forces on South Korean soil. Moon ended by saying that when he returned to Seoul, he would propose to the North a third U.S.-North Korea summit between June 12th and July 27th. Trump said that any date was fine, but only if there were a deal beforehand. Moon kept trying, explaining, as we all knew, that on nuclear issues, the North's working-level diplomats had no discretion, and that he therefore wanted higher-level discussions. Trump replied simply that Pompeo and I would work on this. Prime Minister Abe arrived in Washington on April 26th, offering very nearly the opposite view from Moon's. Trump told Abe he had received good reviews by leaving the Hanoi summit, which people respected. Abe agreed that the outcome was very positive and that Trump was the only person who could walk away. He emphasized repeatedly that it was important to keep up the sanctions, which Kim hated, and make no easy concessions. Abe stressed that time was on our side, and Trump agreed. Unfortunately, North Korea continued testing missiles, not the ICBMs Kim had promised Trump he would not test, but short- and medium-range missiles that threatened much of South Korea and Japan. Some were launched in salvos, approximating wartime conditions, the first of which I heard about on the evening of Friday, May 3rd, Saturday morning, Korea time. I immediately called Pompeo and Shanahan after learning of the first launch to give them a heads up. Shortly thereafter, more launches were reported. After speaking with Dunford, I decided to call Trump to tell him what we knew. The missiles were short range, so there was no immediate threat, but you never knew with the North Koreans. I called Trump a second time a bit later, after still more launches, to say it looked like things were finished for the night. He said in a somewhat agitated voice, "Keep it calm. Play it down. Play it down." Obviously worried people might think his friend, Kim Jong-un, was a touch dangerous. By then, based on public statements by the South Korean Ministry of Defense, press stories were appearing in South Korea, which had more to worry about from short-range missiles. Since State would inevitably be drafting something on our reaction, I concluded, just to be sure, that I needed to check with Trump first. I called him for the third and last time that night about an hour later, and as I suspected, he wanted no statement at all. He ended with, "Okay, man," one of his usual ways of saying he was relaxed about how we'd concluded a particular issue. Statement or not, these ballistic missile tests, whatever the ranges, violated the Security Council resolutions forming the basis of the international sanctions against North Korea. Not that I was concerned about some inviolable status for Council resolutions, but I worried pragmatically that if we dismissed clear violations as immaterial, other nations would learn the wrong lesson and start characterizing significant sanctions violations as de minimis. This was more than a little risky. Just to confirm my fears, when I relayed the latest information to Trump the next morning, he said, "Call it artillery," as if labeling it something it wasn't would make it disappear. He had also tweeted, in part, "Kim Jong-un knows that I am with him and does not want to break his promise to me. Deal will happen." Trump obviously thought these tweets helped him with Kim, but I worried they reinforced the perception he was desperate for a deal and that only his destructive advisors, guess who, stood in the way. We had all given up any idea of stopping the tweeting. All we could do was live with it. Interestingly, South Korea's government was also now calling the rockets projectiles to minimize the story. All this because of a regime in Pyongyang that was beseeching the world for food for its supposedly starving people, but still had enough spare change to engage in missile and nuclear weapons development. Others weren't so resigned. Abe called on Monday, May 6th, to say Kim was getting ever more irritated over the sanctions' effects on North Korea because they were working effectively, and that these new launches were intended to turn the situation in his favor by undermining international unity over the sanctions. Abe said he would completely support Trump's outstanding policy of aiming for a deal and maintaining sanctions and a robust military posture, a posture he still holds publicly. I understood what Abe was trying to do, but I wondered if constantly telling Trump his strategy was brilliant didn't in fact decrease Abe's ability to keep the Trump train on the rails. In fact, Trump suggested Abe put out a statement that Japan and the United States were totally allied so that North Korea would see unambiguously that Japan was with us. He concluded by committing to keep Abe informed, but not to worry, because the launches were short-range and not really missiles. If he said it enough times, perhaps it would become true. The next day, Moon called Trump to speak about the weekend launches. Moon was, unsurprisingly, eager to play down the significance of the issue, about which Trump had already persuaded himself. As Moon rambled on about Kim Jong-un's dissatisfaction with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises, Trump observed that Moon seemed to have lost his relationship with Kim, who was now not traveling to South Korea as once envisaged. Trump didn't see this breakdown as Moon's fault, but obviously something had happened. Moon conceded there still had been few, if any, substantive discussions with North Korea since Hanoi. Somehow, Moon was able to turn that into an argument the U.S. should be giving direct food aid to the North, instead of simply allowing the South to provide it through UNICEF and the World Food Program. Trump answered by saying that he would surprise Moon by giving his complete blessing to releasing the aid through the UN agencies, and asked Moon to let North Korea know that he had suggested it to him. Trump said he was doing this despite hardliners who opposed it because he had a good relationship with Kim and the timing was good. So much for consistency. North Korea could conclude, "We fire missiles and get free food." This was a terrible signal, showing again how eager Trump was for a deal. I stressed to Pottinger and Hooker to make clear to South Korea that we weren't going to be providing any food ourselves. We were simply not objecting to its providing resources, but also insisting that food aid distributed in the North required very careful monitoring. More missile launches followed through the spring and summer, showing Kim's confidence there would be no retaliation. Maybe just more rice. Trump told me on May 9th, after the next salvo, "Put heavy sanctions on," later upgrading that to "massive sanctions," but not to say anything publicly. We made a weather vane look like the Rock of Gibraltar.